For $200 a year for unlimited access, essentially, to the Great Lakes, was the same week that they cut bottled water for Flint. There are people in Flint who still cannot afford water. They are to this day getting shutoffs because they cannot pay their bills for water that they still need to use a filter to drink from. And we grant a corporation unlimited access to the Great Lakes water. It is mind-boggling. It is tone deaf. It is unreal for this to happen.
Flint, Michigan pediatrician Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, her new book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. If you'd like to go back to the documentary we did in Flint when we were there during the height of the crisis, you can go to democracynow.org and put into search Thirsty for Democracy, The Poisoning of an American City. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening for a broadcast engineer. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman.
It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up, Sojourner Truth Radio. The Anti-Police Terror Network weighs in on the killing of Nia Wilson on the Bay Area Transit System. That's coming up next. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell. Her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. Air Cascadia at 10, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers, David Naiman talks with Forrest Gander about his new book of poems, Be With. And at 11:30 on the film show, we welcome legendary Portland filmmaker Gus Van Sant to KBOO to talk about his new movie. Don't worry, he won't get far on foot. And all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm. Click on Donate. It's 801.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center in Portland. The Rosewood Health Fair will provide health and wellness resources to the community, along with sports, physicals, and immunizations for children. There will be food, games, prizes, and a variety of community resources for families. Again, that's Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center, 8935 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. A white man in Oakland fatally stabs a black woman and injures her sister on Sunday evening, July 22nd. 18-year-old Nia Wilson died at the scene. Her 26-year-old sister, Latifa Wilson, was hospitalized. The incident took place on the platform of the BART train, the Bay Area Public Transport System. A suspect, a young white man, is in custody. We cover this on this week's edition of Campaigners for Black Lives. And is the welfare of children truly at the forefront of county child welfare systems across the U.S.? Why is it that attention is only brought to abuses in the system when a child dies? And what is the lifelong trauma that children face when they are separated from their families, either under the guise of border security or simply because their families are poor? What is the situation in LA County? Why is the foster care system being referred to as the new Jane Crow? And the outrage of hundreds of children snatched by the Trump administration at the border who now may never be reunited with their families. What is the interrelationship between what is happening to children at the border and child welfare agencies? We speak to Richard Wexler, Executive Director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform. We continue follow-up to my recent trip to Europe. Our guest is Dr. Deirdre McHugh with the National University of Ireland. We discuss how the U.S. civil rights movement inspired Irish anti-colonial movements in Northern Ireland in their long struggle against British rule, domination, and discrimination. Also, our weekly Earth Minute is back. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. 2 months before the 2016 election, Donald Trump and his former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen discussed plans to pay for a former Playboy model story of an alleged affair. That's according to a secretly recorded tape of the conversation released amid an escalating feud between Trump and his longtime personal attorney. The tape was provided to CNN by Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis. The men appear to be discussing buying the rights to Karen McDougal's story from the Inquirer's parent company, although the conversation is hard to follow.
When it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to pay you. So
I'll pay
for No. I got...
The two sides immediately disputed what the tape shows. Trump's lawyers say the payments were never made. But the surreptitiously recorded audio appears to contradict the Trump campaign's later claim that Trump knew nothing about payments to a media company to keep McDougal's story from becoming public. The taped conversation between Trump and Cohen came weeks after the National Enquirer's parent company, headed by a Trump friend, reached a $150,000 deal to pay McDougal for her story of a 2006 affair. The story was never published, a tabloid practice known as catch and kill. Trump tweets this morning, it's so sad. Cohen would record their discussions. Greek rescue and recovery crews are searching through hundreds of charred homes and cars for those still missing after the deadliest wildfires to hit Greece in decades decimated seaside areas near Athens. The death toll stands at 75. There's no official indication of how many people might be missing. A member of the Red Cross spoke to the media after finding bodies in the seaside town of Mati.
Early this morning, we discovered, apart from three other victims further away, this place where, unfortunately, there are 26 people, men, women, and unfortunately, children. We found cars with the keys left in the ignition, the doors open, and first aid supplies left on the seats.
Survivors described dramatic scenes of people fleeing to beaches and being forced to swim out to sea despite gale-force winds and high waves. They were trying to escape choking smoke and flaming pine cones raining down into the water. Rescuers are searching for missing villagers after an auxiliary dam broke in southeastern Laos, flooding the surrounding countryside and killing at least 19 people. Media reports said thousands were waiting to be rescued, some sitting on rooftops amid surging waters. The dam gave way after heavy rain. Two South Korean companies are involved in building a massive dam project in Laos, with 90% of the power set to go to neighboring Thailand. International Rivers, a non-governmental group generally critical of such projects, said the catastrophe shows the need to improve warning systems. The International Rivers Group said with over 70 hydropower projects currently built, under construction, and planned across Laos, most of them owned and operated by private companies, authorities must immediately review how dams are being planned, designed, and managed. The Japan Times reports the death toll in that country has reached 77 as a result of an unprecedented heat wave and high humidity. Temperatures rose to 106 degrees yesterday, the highest ever recorded in Japan. More than 30,000 people have been hospitalized for heat-related illnesses since last week. Yosemite National Park closes to all tourists at noon today, the first closure since 1990. Officials ordered tourists to leave Yosemite as firefighters battle to contain a huge wildfire just to the west. A spokesman for the Georgia House Speaker says the state Republican lawmaker who exposed his bare bottom and yelled racial slurs on Sacha Baron Cohen's new cable TV series will resign. In Sunday night's broadcast of Cohen's series, Who is America?, Cohen masquerades as an Israeli anti-terrorism expert providing training to Republican Jason Spencer. He asked Spencer to take part in a counter-terrorism video. Spencer repeatedly shouts the N-word after Cohen tells him the tactic is useful for drawing bystander attention to an unfolding attack. He also drops his pants, then his underwear, before backing his exposed rear toward Cohen while shouting USA and America after Cohen tells him that Islamic State terrorists are terrified of gay people. A federal appeals court has ruled that the Second Amendment protects the right to openly carry a gun in public for self-defense. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals panel ruled 2-1 that Hawaii officials violated George Young's rights when he was denied a permit to openly carry a loaded gun in public to protect himself. If the appeals panel ruling stands, it could lead to more guns in public in the few western states under the Ninth Circuit jurisdiction where they're currently restricted, such as California. I'm Eileen Alfandera. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And before we go into our first story today, there are a couple of deaths that we would like to report. Part of our family here at KPFK in Southern California. First, Kamal Ramsey. She was a host along with Mary Kara of Inner Visions on KPFK, and she was his co-host, and she has passed away. There was a memorial service for her this past Saturday. I found out about her death a bit late in the day, and just trying to get some more information about it, and we'll share with our audience. For those of you who know her or know of her work, that is Kamal Ramsey. The other thing, death, is that we're also very sad to announce the death of Aris Agnos. He passed away with his family at his side on Monday. He was born in Athens, Greece in 1923, where he served in the Greek army in World War II. During the Nazi occupation of Greece, he escaped to the Middle East and joined the Free Greek Exile Army, which fought in the North African Desert campaigns along with the Allies against the German and Italian troops. After the war, he served with the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration in the rehabilitation of the war-devastated Greece. He came to the United States in 1946, where he attended UCLA. He was politically active, opposing the war in Korea, the war in Vietnam, and all of the various wars the U.S. administrations wage or sponsored around the world. He supported the Cuban people in their 1959 revolution and opposed the Bay of Pigs invasion and the other hostile policies against Cuba. He also opposed various dictatorships that were supported by the United States in south of the border in Latin America and elsewhere, including the CIA-imposed dictatorship in Greece in 1967. Throughout his life, he supported various peace and human rights causes nationally and internationally. He served on the board of directors of the ACLU of Southern California for 28 years, including a few years as president. He also served several years as president of the Southern California chapter of ADA, Americans for Democratic Action, and the Humanitarian Law Project. He was very active in opposing the Contra War in Nicaragua and dictatorships in El Salvador and in Guatemala. And in 2013, Nicaragua's national holiday, President Daniel Ortega awarded Agnos the Rubén Darío Medal, the highest decoration of the Republic of Nicaragua. He also received the Frente Farabunda Martí Medal from the FMLN in El Salvador. The Progressive Coalition, which fought the dictatorship in El Salvador for 12 years and is now the democratic government in El Salvador. He's been awarded the Ralph Bunche Peace Award by the United Nations Association. He is also very well known among KPFK, our Southern California station listeners. By in 1988, he established the Peace Center in Los Angeles, which is now located in Culver City. All of the peace and justice groups who have offices in the Peace Center have received free rent from Addis Agnos since 1988. He has now passed away, and I do remember him fondly, really, as a gentle giant, very, very committed to human rights, and not only here in the United States, but around the world. And in the tradition of Sojourner Truth, we are now going to play the mourning song in honor of these two recent deaths, and that is Lubu from Na Afriki. It is sung in Dida.
O koloka o pepe kukulu, o pepe kukulu, o pepe kukulu, nyamboko ngala, nyamboko ngala, o koloka lo. Oh, kolokalo, yeah, kolokalo, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, we remember those who have passed on. Now, we'll now go to our Campaigners for Black Lives segment. Let me know when we have our guest on the line for that segment. On Sunday night, July 22nd, three black sisters, three black women who were returning from a family event were apprehended by a white man who stabbed two of the sisters. Nia Wilson, 18 years old, died at the scene. Her sister, 26-year-old Latifah Wilson, was hospitalized with stab wounds to her neck. A third sister was not injured in the attack, this according to ABC News. The suspect is 27-year-old John Cowell, a young white man. He was arrested on Monday, July 23rd, by Oakland police. He was booked on assault with a deadly weapon following for violating parole and first-degree murder. Now, this happened on the platform of the BART system, BART being the public transportation system of the Bay Area. So here to discuss all of this with us, including the community concerns and response, I'd like to welcome James Birch, who is the policy director of the Anti-Police Terror Project and policy coordinator, and he is based in Oakland, California. Welcome, James.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, so right now I'm seeing reports that the family, of course, is of the suspect is saying, well, he was mentally ill, and police, in fact, let's play this clip. Let's hear what the chief of police has had to say about this.
Everything that we've uncovered up to this point, we see no altercation. We don't have any information that there was any type of dispute. It looks like it's a unprovoked, unwarranted, vicious attack. up to this point, we do not have any information that suggests it is race motivated, but we can't discount it at this time. We don't have a motive at this time. So that is currently still under investigation.
James Birch, your response.
I think the response from the chief of police is frustrating and all too typical. We find that in situations like this, the state are the last folks who are willing to call what we see what it is, right? You know, again, what it looks like to us, and we're not jumping to any conclusions, look like this is a race-based attack. This white man, 27 years old, went up to two young black women who he did not know and stabbed them viciously on the train. And then one other thing, and it's very important into our analysis of this situation, is that whether or not John Cowell himself was a white supremacist, we see white supremacy all over this issue. You know, immediately after John Cowell stabbed and killed Mia Wilson and stabbed his sister, he somehow was able to leave the BART station and travel freely, you know, for almost a day before he being captured. And he was captured on the BART, but he wasn't captured because BART police or the Oakland Police Department identified and discovered him. It was because of an anonymous caller who identified that Cowell was on his train. And so I know as a black man in America, if I was wanted for the murder of someone on a BART train, that I could absolutely not go back to BART without being arrested, guaranteed on the spot. That's just how black folks are treated. But John Cowell, as a white man, not only felt able to continue to travel on the BART after committing such vicious murders, he didn't feel like he needed to lay on the low or hide out. As a white person, he recognized his privilege to be able to go back on the BART. It was only because of another passenger that he was ultimately captured.
Yeah, it's always interesting when these kinds of attacks happen and the perpetrator is not black, that immediately, there's mental illness that was involved. But it just seems as though if, in fact, and likely, you know, one would have to assume if his family says that's the case, that was the case. You can't deny the racial element of it, of just in the whole atmosphere of what's happening in the country right now of approaching these black women and stabbing them. Tell us also about the response from the community. Are people outraged? Have there been any protests about it? What are any demands that have come up thus far?
Yes, absolutely. The community response has been beautiful. Last night, there was a vigil that lasted from at the MacArthur BART station, the scene of the incident, that lasted from I think it started around 4 p.m. And went at least until I went back through around 10:30 p.m. and folks were still there holding space. You know, telling stories, just being in community. The black community really came out and held each other in a really beautiful way. Also, there was something for everyone. A lot of folks stayed at that BART station and had a vigil in remembrance of Mia Wilson. Again, Mia Wilson was a graduate of Oakland High School. She's full of life, smart, beautiful beyond words. She was a rapper. They were playing her songs both at the vigil at the MacArthur BART station and then ultimately, we ended up marching from the MacArthur BART station to 17th and Telegraph, which is in downtown Oakland. There were a bunch of Proud Boys who are a small group of white supremacists. I believe they classify themselves as, well, it doesn't even matter, they're white supremacists. They were planning to meet at a bar in downtown Oakland, right? Mm-hmm. And so again, one of the things that we do see is when these white supremacists come to town, there is race-based violence that precedes and follows them. I remember last summer when the alt-right came to Berkeley on several occasions. Windows of pro-LGBTQ establishments were destroyed. People were assaulted in the streets. You know, there was a lot of collateral damage that comes when you allow white supremacists to congregate in the area. I mean, we saw the roving bands of folks in Charlottesville after the rallies were over. I mean, it creates dangerous conditions for people in the streets. And so one of the intentions for some of the folks, sorry, not even some, it's, you know, extended the thing, over 1,000 of us who were marching, wanted to march to 17th and Telegraph to send a message to the city that white supremacy was not welcome here. And so again, it was a beautiful scene. The black community came together beautifully.
Yeah, and there also in Southern California, a white supremacist organization, they got into a fight in a bar, and then several of them threatened to show up outside the office of Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and the community came out, and they didn't really show their faces, and now apparently her office has received a suspicious package addressed to Anthrax, so we'll see this continuing. Now, finally, you know, Oakland is known, I mean, the Black Panther Party founded there, and in fact, we have to do something on the Black Panther Party co-founder, Albert Big Man Howard, who recently died. So there's that history of activism in the Black community there. Also, recently, the film, Sorry to Bother You, Boots Riley, who himself is out of Oakland, you know, has gained national attention and gives a slice of Oakland. So just your response, because all of this is happening where there's been this history of black folks in Oakland. At the same time, there is massive gentrification going on and black folks are being forced out of the city. And then you have these racists having the nerve to show up.
For sure. I think one of the things that came out clearly from the community yesterday is that Mia Wilson's death in a way represents the devaluation of black bodies that's going on in Oakland right now. We see this devaluation everywhere we look. As you said, the city's on the front lines of gentrification. We're facing mass displacement. There are over 6,000 houseless folks living on our streets, and the city's failing to meaningfully address that crisis, and over 70% of those folks are black. They're failing to provide meaningful programming for our youth. Really, the city is failing the black community on every front. And one of the strongest messages that came out last night, as opened as one of the bastions of resistance, was the response to the chant, "Who keeps us safe? We keep us safe." Mm. I think we're really internalizing and understanding what that means in 2018, not only when it comes to the black community, when it comes to the black and brown solidarity, black Muslim solidarity, our indigenous folks, you know, our queer community, everyone is under attack right now, and it is our responsibility to keep us safe. And so, as a black community, I think our priority is, first and foremost, is to figure out how to do that for ourselves and establish those systems, and at the same time, to provide resources and support where we can for other impacted communities, so we can, you know, share resources and all protect each other in such trying times.
Right. Well, we want to thank you for taking the time to join us, James Birch, Policy Director of the Anti-Police Terror Project and also the Policy Coordinator for the Cat Brooks for Oakland mayoral campaign. Thank you so very much, James.
And thanks for having me.
And we want to thank the Black Lives Matter LA, in particular Dr. Melina Abdullah. We partner with them for our weekly Campaigners for Black Lives. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we're now going to return to the whole topic of what's happening to our children, the snatching of children at the border from immigrant families. And now there are hundreds of children snatched by the Trump administration at the border who the administration is saying now may never be reunited with their families because the families have already been deported. Now, this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to child snatching, because people are now referring to the foster care system as the new Jane Crow. We are going to uncover what all of that is about, because the wrongful taking of children and the trauma, the lifelong trauma resulting from this has been going on in the United States underreported for decades now. and it very serious consequences. And indeed, what happens is that children are all too often taken, not because of abuse, but because their families are poor. And meanwhile, child welfare departments are so busy overtaking too many children that the children in need of protection don't get it. And the only time this really gets reported or gets attention is when a child sadly dies in foster care, and then everybody throws up their hands and says, oh, this must never happen again, et cetera, et cetera. Before we welcome our guests, I'd like to go to two clips. Can we start with the Trump administration defending their policy, and then we'll hear from a mom pleading for her children?
You know, what's really amazing, that this is the United States. In this country, we could go online, track a package from the Postal Service or UPS or FedEx, but now we're in a situation, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Secretary, where the federal government is struggling to locate some of these parents, struggling to reunite these little kids with their mothers and fathers. So why can't the government meet this federal deadline by the courts to clean up its own mess?
Well, Wolf, we could put children back with individuals who are murderers, kidnappers, rapists, or are not their parents, but we've worked with the court to ensure that we do our duty, which is to protect child welfare and ensure that they are in fact that. I could release all of the kids by 10:55 p.m., but I don't think you want that. I know the court doesn't want that, and I don't think even our political opponents want that to happen.
But you've had these children for a long time, some of them for months and months, and presumably you know where their parents are, unless they were deported to El Salvador or Honduras or other countries, and they weren't allowed to take their children with them.
Well, I don't think a kidnapper or a child abuser or a child trafficker ought to be able to take a kid out of the country or be reunited in ICE facilities, and I don't think the court believes that either. And if we hadn't done this work, if we hadn't done our work to protect child welfare by confirming parentage and doing criminal background checks on these individuals, these children would have been reunited in exceedingly dangerous situations. I'm proud of the work that we do. I believe we are saving kids' lives here by the work we're doing before we're connecting these with these purported parents.
Le suplico, por favor, que no me expulse del país. Hágalo por mi hijo.
I am begging, Your Honor, please do not remove me from the country.
No tengo nada más. No tengo a nadie más por mí.
Do it for me or for my son.
Se lo suplico.
How old is your child?
7 años.
And where is your child?
No sé, me dijeron que aquí en Texas.
Just a heartbreak there. I'm a mom, and it, you know, unbelievable what's happening. Let me welcome our guest here, Richard Wexler, Executive Director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform. Richard Wexler, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here again.
So, Richard Wexler, hearing that mother cry, first of all, the Trump administration representative was just lying when he said they could release all of the children tomorrow, because clearly that's not the case. There are now hundreds of children who the Trump administration is now saying may never be reunited with their families, families who are already deported, and perhaps others as well. But listening to that mom, Richard, it reminded me of really sitting in children's court in Los Angeles in Southern California and watching that scene play out again and again and again of mothers or grandmothers weeping as, you know, and pleading, begging for their child not to be taken from them, but detained all too often for no good reason. Just put those two things together and let us know, too, why there are some that are now referring to the child welfare system as the new Jane Crow.
Sure. Well, there are a couple of really interesting elements there. First of all, it's not only, of course, the mothers who weep. Anybody who has listened to the audio tape smuggled out of a detention center and published by ProPublica of the sounds of the children crying will understand how enormously traumatic any form of child removal, destroying the bond between parent and child, or trying to, can be. And the children who are taken by Child Protective Services workers, those workers generally mean well, but that doesn't help the children. They shed the same sorts of tears for the same sorts of reasons. They endure the same sorts of trauma. The reason it has been called the new Jane Crow, and that comes from a headline actually in a New York Times story, is because of the profound double standards that permeate the system, both in terms of racial and class bias. That headline was on a story, for example, about a mother who, were she white and middle class, would be the subject of mommy blogs about how much she cared and doted upon her children. But after one exhausting day, she went to take a bath in the bathroom. She thought her 5-year-old daughter was asleep. She wasn't. She got up and wandered out of the house. As one lawyer said, in a middle-class family, that's an oh-my-God story to be told later. For a poor family, it's labeled endangering the welfare of your child. Mm. That's exactly what the police and Child Protective Services did in this New York City case. The mother was jailed overnight. The child was placed in foster care for several days. And of course, if you don't think several days is enormously is a brief period and isn't really traumatic, well, again, just listen to the cries of the children on the border.
Yeah, and Los Angeles County, they are particularly egregious in terms of them, the numbers of children that they take, and perhaps you could share some information on that. I think they're more than double the rate of New York City and that triple the rate of Chicago, that's right?
Yes, and that's part of the irony here, that story in the New York Times was based on the New York City system.
Yeah.
So multiply that, and you get Los Angeles, where the rate of removal is more than double the rate in New York City. There is, of course, no evidence that children in Los Angeles are twice as safe from abuse as children in New York City. And that brings me to that first clip you played, which I had not heard before, and is the most striking parallel I have seen to date. I hope your listeners will listen very carefully, will think about exactly what that Trump administration official said, because it is almost word for word the justification Child Protective Services agencies use for the massive, unnecessary removal of children. They throw horror stories at you. Well, some of those parents might be terrible. Some of them might be sadistic brutes. You wouldn't want us to send the children back to them, do you? So exactly the same kind of fear and smear that the Trump administration is using is how Child Protective Services agencies justify removing children in thousands of cases that are nothing like the horror stories.
Yeah, and then in Los Angeles County, I mean, you have the board of supervisors that throw their hands up. I mean, when a child dies, I mean, and you wrote an article, Los Angeles Child Welfare, the Definition of Insanity. but just the tragedy of the death of Anthony Avalos, right? And why these, you know, why do you think that, you know, these deaths happen, and the counties, not only in Los Angeles, but likely in other parts of the country as well, seem to respond again and again in exactly the same way and don't really get to the underlying problem.
Yes.
Richard Wexler.
I called the NCCPR blog problem Los Angeles Child Welfare the Definition of Insanity because it's been said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. And that's what happens in Los Angeles County. It happens in a great many places. Los Angeles is one of the worst. What happens is you have a high-profile case. The members of the Board of Supervisors rush to grab headlines. They put out fill-in-the-blank type press releases that say, name of supervisor here demands answers. And all that does is scare everyone into taking away even more children. It sets off a foster care panic. No one wants to be the next target of the Board of Supervisors or the Los Angeles Times, so they rush to tear apart even more families. That further overloads the system. So as a result, workers have less time to investigate any case carefully, so it actually makes the next tragedy even more likely. When you look at the cases, the horror story cases in which it turns out the case file had so many different warning signs, Mostly what you find is a grossly overwhelmed, underprepared caseworker who didn't have time to look closely. Well, this is what steals the time, taking away all these children needlessly, the foster care panic. So when the supervisors throw gasoline on that fire, as they do over and over and over again, they simply perpetuate the cycle. Possibly the single dumbest comment I have seen yet in response to this most recent tragedy was the supervisor who said, "I thought after the last tragedy this would never happen again." Mm. Well, it's never stopped happening. Sadly, there is no system that can prevent every child abuse death. And in a giant system like Los Angeles, tragically, there will always be some. They have never stopped. It's just every few years, one death, for arbitrary and capricious reasons, happens to grab people's attention. So the cycle keeps perpetuating itself.
Right. And, you know, it's good in a way that people are now discussing the negative impacts of children being taken from their mothers in particular, but from their families. And by the way, the Trump administration person that was heard in that clip is Alex Azar, the health and from the Department of Health and Human Services. But Richard Wexler, before we have to wrap this up, tell us now about these kind of studies that are being done, where they are trying to predict which families are likely to to abuse their children. And we know that there's really a racist element to all of this in terms of who are the children that are percentage-wise being taken. Richard Wexler.
It basically amounts to computerized racial profiling. It's the same sort of thing that has been done in criminal justice, and it is likely to have the same sorts of effects. ProPublica did an expose of so-called predictive analytics, in which a computer algorithm is supposed to predict what's going to happen. They did it in criminal justice, and it was, you know, can you give probation or parole to someone, or free the person without bail? And they found that it was twice as likely to overstate risk if the accused were black and understate risk if the accused were white. Well, you do the same thing in child welfare, and you are likely to get the same results. There is a superb book about this called Automating Inequality by Professor Virginia Eubanks of SUNY Albany, a fascinating read, and it talks about how in Pittsburgh, where this is most advanced, most of the indicators that supposedly predict risk to children are basically indicators of poverty. She aptly calls it poverty profiling. When Los Angeles experimented with this, their initial attempt had a false positive rate of 95%. In other words, 95% of the time when they said something terrible was going to happen to a child, it didn't.
Yeah. And actually, that Judge Michael Nash, the director of the county's Office of Child Protection, he also agreed with that assessment of yours about the 95% of the time there was a negative outcome here. We are going to have to leave it there, but we want to return to this topic because it's so underreported, and there's an epidemic going on across the United States of children being taken from their families, not because of abuse, but because the families are poor, and then children who need protection not getting it. And by the way, even before the news broke about the taking of children at the border, mothers who were being deported to Mexico and other places had their children taken and put up for foster care, and in some cases losing entirely parental rights. So that's another area that we're going to have to look at. But Richard Wexler, we appreciate your work. Thank you for joining us. And people could go see your blog where should they go?
The website is nccpr.org. The NCCPR Child Welfare blog is at nccprblog.org.
All righty. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. Coming up, our weekly Earth Minute, and then we're going to return to Ireland, what's going on there, and what has been the history of the movements in Northern Ireland and its connection with the civil rights movement in the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:44. Press Watch is coming up in about 15 minutes.
And you've got no bloody homes of your own. For 800 years, we fought you without fear. And we'll fight you for 800 more.
The soldiers took the streets in 69 to protect the people at that time. In Derry and Belfast, but the peace it did not last. You were shooting people down and wrecking homes.
So go on home, British soldiers, go on home. Have you got no bloody homes of your own?
Alrighty, and that's Go On Home, British Soldiers, and that is connected to the next segment coming up. That's the Wolf Tones with that song. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you miss any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. You can check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. Where there is a community calendar, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. And also, we'd like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. You could look for us on SoundCloud and just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Today, we'd like to do two shout-outs, actually, one in the United States and one internationally. We want to give a shout-out to our SoundCloud listeners in Columbus, Ohio, of which we have set many, and also in Australia. Yes, there are Sojourner Truth listeners in Australia as well. We're now quickly going to go to our weekly Earth Minute, and then Dr. Deirdre McHugh waiting to join us.
Last Friday, activists from across the world protested the murders of at least 313 Colombian human rights defenders that have occurred over the last 2 years, only days after four more activists were murdered in Colombia. The protest took place at the United Nations headquarters in New York during a meeting on ways to tackle issues like poverty, hunger, and climate change. While Colombia participated, it said nothing about the escalating violence in the country, despite its focus on social leaders, environmental, and human rights defenders. The violence has escalated since the signing of the peace agreement in 2016 between the Revolutionary Armed Forces, known as FARC, and the Colombian government. In Colombia, hundreds of social and community leaders, including environmental, indigenous, and union activists, are being murdered right under the government's nose, said activist Diego Cardona. The protest condemned the Colombian government and called for countries to denounce the murders, threats, and harassment of human rights and environmental defenders. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
Okay, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, when most people talk about political activism in Europe, they think of France, in the UK, England, Germany. Germany, after all, was the home of Karl Marx, one of the most influential political figures, according to many of his supporters in the last two centuries. England, home of some of the first labor unions, and France, the home to the Jacobins, the Paris Commune, the historic May 1968 student protests. But there's one European nation with a rich tradition of political protests and activism that's rarely mentioned, and that is Ireland, okay? And even when the struggles in Ireland are reported, it's very hard to understand, because in the United States, they talk about Protestants and Catholics killing each other, and you really are fighting with each other, and you get no idea about what is going on. And even lesser known is the relationship between the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland and the civil rights movement in the United States. But here to break all of that down for us, I'd like to welcome Dr. Deirdre McHugh. She works at the National University of Ireland. She is a trade unionist. She's a member of the Global Women's Strike. And Dr. Deirdre McHugh, welcome.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay. So,
and
Yes, there's a very, very rich history of civil rights in Ireland, going back to what became the Republic of Ireland's struggle to win independence from Britain. But
and that was in 1921, right? And when the country was partitioned. Tell us about that. But also, I want to let our audience know that prior to that, I mean, there's been that history of the cleansing of Ireland from the Irish, going back to Cromwell, and many of those Irish people being sent as indentured servants actually to places like Barbados, right? So it's been a long struggle going on in Ireland. So tell us about the partitioning.
It has, it has. So when Ireland was partitioned in 1921, the six northeastern counties that had a Protestant majority, and for Protestant, really you're reading ethnically British. It was an ethnic conflict between those who identified as British citizens and those who identified as Irish citizens, really, when you're looking at the modern conflict from the late 1960s onwards. So when it was partitioned, it left a two-third majority, a British nationalist majority in Northern Ireland, and a one-third Catholic Irish minority who experienced segregation, sectarianism, and discrimination in all walks of life in Northern Ireland. So this situation developed and built up, and gradually over the decades, Northern Ireland became more separate to the rest of the island that had gained its independence, and also separate to Britain as well, and quite a unique situation developed there. So from the middle of the 1960s onwards, civil rights movements began to develop in Northern Ireland. An early one was the Campaign for Social Justice, which took place in London and Westminster, and sought to improve conditions for the oppressed minority in Northern Ireland. But really things started to get going in 1967 when an organization called the Northern Irish Civil Rights Campaign, or the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, was formed. And that was an umbrella group of lots of small grassroots civil rights organizations, for example, the Derry Housing Action Committee. And its key demands were for one man, one vote in local elections, because at the time, only ratepayers could vote in elections, and business owners had more votes than householders. Another demand was an end to discrimination in housing and employment, an end to the gerrymandering of electoral boundaries, whereby they were the electoral boundaries were manipulated to ensure a British nationalist majority, the repeal of the Special Powers Act, which allowed the government to set up juryless courts and to really to do whatever it wanted to do what it saw fit to preserve law and order, which meant repression, and the disbandment of a sectarian reserve police force called the B Specials. So they began to organize small-scale protests. An early one took place in a small town called, in a village really called Caledon, where an Irish nationalist politician led the squatting of a house that had been allocated to a single Protestant woman who worked for the local councillor, rather than many of the large Catholic families who were on the housing list. And the first civil rights march took place in August 1968, and it was actually based on the Selma to Montgomery march in the United States. It was from one small town, Coal Island, to another, Dungannon. But things really kicked off on October 5th, 1968, when a banned civil rights march in Derry went ahead, but was met by extreme brutality on behalf of the police force. However, this was captured by television cameras from the Republic of Ireland, and these images were sent around the world, and that caused international outrage. So it really kind of catapulted the issue of civil rights abuses in Northern Ireland onto the international stage.
Right. Let me ask you this, Deirdre, because you mentioned the Selma to Montgomery march and inspired that particular march in 67, but likely also 68 in Northern Ireland. And of course, on the Selma to Montgomery march in the United States, there was also great brutality, right, and great violence against them. Now, the reason I'm underscoring this is I'm sure a lot of black folks listening to this are thinking, well, you know what? Our experience with the Irish, particularly on the East Coast, in Boston is one particular area, but in New York City, where Irish immigrants or descendants of Irish immigrants often went into the police force. And when they were in Ireland, I mean, it was interesting because it was coming to the United States that they became white, right? I mean, Joy DeGruy in Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome has a whole thing about the definition of whiteness. So, and then they were then used, the Irish were then used to repress black folks and, you know, people of color here in the United States. So it's interesting to know that, to contrast that then with what was going on in the movement in Northern Ireland, who were in so many ways inspired and watching closely the civil rights and black movements in the United States, Deirdre McHugh.
Yes, so you're absolutely right. The Irish did become very, very white and have a terrible reputation, particularly in New York City, for being racist. Now, there is a strong kind of conservative strand to Irish history, but that was challenged by the members of the civil rights campaign in Northern Ireland. So, after that period, after the march in 1968, which was filmed, another group started up called the People's Democracy, and that was a student-led movement. It had very kind of anarchistic spirit. It identified with oppressed people across the world, and one of the key figures from that movement is Bernadette McCallisky, at the time Bernadette Devlin. So she challenged the traditional kind of Irish, what we call the God and the Gun strand of republicanism, the very conservative strand. But there was another strand, which was the socialist strand. And People's Democracy was a little different to that again, because it focused on civil rights as an issue in itself, rather than focusing on nationalism. Or such things. And in 1969 there was another march from Derry to from Belfast to Derry, also emulated on Selma to Montgomery, and that ended in violence when it was ambushed by a mob from the loyalist community. But Bernadette McCallisky herself, or Bernadette Devlin, went to the United States on a fundraising tour in 1969, mm-hmm. and she challenged this conservative Irish Catholic kind of view of the conflict. And it wasn't received well by a lot of Irish Americans who didn't identify with black people. But I find a very interesting article from 1970 from the New York Times, the 3rd of March 1970. The title is "Irish Give Key to City to Panthers as a Symbol." So when Bernadette went to the stage, she was lauded as this icon, as this hero, but she wanted to emphasize the connection that she felt with black people in the United States. So she had actually left the tour at this stage, but her colleague Emma McCann presented the key, the freedom of the city of New York, to the Black Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
So as a gesture of solidarity with the black liberation and revolutionary socialist movements in America. And he read out a statement for her in which she said that she sympathized with black Americans who are in slums, who are hated because they are black and despised because they are poor. to all these people to whom this city and this country belong, I return what is rightfully theirs, this symbol of the freedom of New York.
Wow, that's really amazing. And you know, just looking at what you say about the demands in the 1960s from the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, when you look at a repeal of a repressive policing act, disbandment of sectarian reserve police force, that reminds me of the call now to disband ICE, you know, for example.
Yes.
The end discrimination in housing and employment. I mean, it really sounds like a number of the demands and issues that the Black Panther Party were dealing with, but also the movement of today is dealing with. And Deirdre, we just have a couple of minutes, but I got was reading an article in a Black women's magazine called Essence recently, and they were talking about places that Black women who are traveling on their own could go. And one of the places they listed was Northern Ireland. I was really interested, and the Black woman who wrote it said she was really shocked. Traveling in Europe, she expected to meet this wall of racism, and she said in Northern Ireland, she'd go into a pub and people would be like, oh, a Black American, free drinks, right? So she was really surprised by the kind of welcome that that she got there. I mean, that's not to undercover any racism that I'm sure is going on there as well, but this is a very interesting and little known connection, Deirdre. Just a final yes. word. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, and a very, very strong one. And it was a cultural connection as well as a political one as well. So how Bernadette Devlin and her fellow students heard about the Black Civil Rights Movement was, on the one hand, through television, watching protests that were taking place in the United States, but another way was through folk music. They identified with the struggle that was put forward in Black folk songs, and the Folk Music Society in the university sang Black folk music.
Wow.
We Shall Overcome became the theme song of the Northern Ireland Civil
what?
Rights Campaign.
Yeah.
And so and also there's a very strong tradition of solidarity with Palestine in Northern
right.
Ireland as well.
Okay, well,
and this is the thing,
Deirdre, that's a good note, actually, to end it on, because we are out of time, but we'll need to discuss this further. We appreciate your work for bringing this to us, and you've researched this topic. Dr. Deirdre McHugh, thank you so very much for joining us.